listening to On the Couch with Carly. Carly's couch is a safe space to talk. I'm a psychologist, but I'm not your pipe-smoking, tweed-wearing stereotype.
Hello. I just wanted to come on here before you listen to this episode. I feel it is important to say a few things. In this episode, myself and another Jewish person discuss the conflict in Israel and Palestine from quite a far distance. We are talking quite conceptually about Jewish identity and how caring about Palestine affects us in particular, but many Jewish people around the world, in terms of our sense of belonging to a greater Jewish community. But I thought it was important to just say that there is a lot that could have been said on this episode that didn't get said. And most importantly, to say that this conversation was not highlighting the grave injustice that is occurring to people living in Gaza, particularly now, but for a long time. And that a lot of people really just want us to pay more attention to that and for that to be the absolute central topic that we discuss more than anything. And I just want to acknowledge that and state that it might seem insensitive that two Jewish people are talking about their identity and not talking about children and people starving to death in Gaza. So I'm aware of everything that is going on. And it's just to say that is not what this episode is about, but I am deeply affected by the images and stories that come out of Gaza and have been coming out every day for a long time. And it is a devastating situation. And I can link to some amazing organizations that you could perhaps send money to or assist in some way. I think we can do a little bit in our own individual capacity and that it is worthwhile. And if you are doing something in particular that you feel is important, I would love to hear from you what you're doing and how that's helping. And yeah, thank you for listening.
Okay, so hello and welcome back to On the Couch with Carly. Today I have a very special guest, Mr. Joseph Dana. Joe is a journalist and writer, and I have asked him to join me for this conversation specifically because of his expert knowledge of the region of Israel and Palestine, and having lived in Ramallah and worked as a journalist on the ground there, I feel like, Joe, you are well versed and with the right knowledge to speak to these topics. Before we start, I just want to put a disclaimer out there that I am speaking to a journalist, and so your journalistic credentials are important here, but this podcast is by no means a journalistic podcast. We're not delivering news. This is not about facts. I do not claim to be in any way interested in reporting on the facts. I'm here to speak to the psychological, emotional concepts that I think are relevant and important from this issue, this topic. And I hope that together we'll make meaning. I hope together that we'll dive into concepts like identity and intergenerational trauma. And those are the things that we're going to talk about today. So yeah, without further ado, maybe Joe, you can start by telling us what your experience was kind of as a Jewish man who then moved to Ramallah and worked as a journalist there, and what you experienced and how that informs how you see the region and the conflict today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Let me actually start a little bit earlier because I think it's important for the identity aspect of our conversation. I was born in the United States. to a Jewish mother from a very proudly kind of reform household, which for the South Africans listening, reform in the United States is a much different concept than it is in South Africa. It's much more mainstream. And my father was Catholic of a very proud German Austrian heritage. So right off the bat, I was born into kind of one of the major issues, or not issues, but one of the major polarities in the Jewish community today, which is an intermarried family. Judaism was the dominant religion. I wasn't served up too much Catholicism, but my parents divorced when I was six, and my father quickly left the picture, leaving me in an obvious psychological state as a small child. But as I got older, I leaned much deeper into my Jewishness, let's call it, as a way of separating myself from the abandonment of my father. And so you can see right off the bat, that's very ripe and fertile ground for like a militantly nationalist movement, right? When I was 16, I did a half year in high school in Israel, which was kind of like I don't know if we have anything similar in South Africa, but it's quite popular in the States. It's kind of like a birthright on steroids, like a very long birthright trip. And even there at the time, before I was 18, I had my father's family name, which is Sinz, Sinz, which is not the most Jewish name one would think of. And I can remember just even arriving in Israel and having the names on all of the kind of rooms, the dorm rooms, and mine was Joseph Sinz, and it was very uncomfortable. So right off the bat, it's been this inability to try and find a spot. I went to Israel and I found this connection there because it felt like something that was accepting me. It felt like a movement like Zionism writ large and the whole Israeli thing felt like something that would accept me. And my mother's family, like I said, was a very reformed Jewish family. My great grandmother was the national president of Hadassah, which is a massive women's Zionist organization. I grew up hearing stories about how she would take Golda Meir shopping in New York when Golda Meir would come to the United Nations, and they would joke about how she had all of these like terribly like schmata clothing. And so my great grandmother would take her shopping, which if you've seen Golda Meir, that tracks. And so this was very big in my imagination. I did the high school in Israel thing, came back very Zionist, right? Very rah-rah, like almost kind of like right-wing Zionist, I guess what I would say, like pushing it even more beyond just I love Israel. It was like I'm into like far right, Netanyahu is great, let's settle everything kind of Zionism, which is a byproduct of what a lot of these things do, these programs. That waned when I got back to the States a little bit, but I decided to start exploring Jewish history from an academic perspective. So I did my first degree in medieval Jewish philosophy and then just kept going deeper into Judaism and the history of the Jews, somewhat separated from the Israelis. I'll fast forward a little bit. After finishing my undergraduate degree, I decided to emigrate to Israel. So I wanted to continue my studies in Jewish history, and there are a lot of good programs in Israel for that type of thing. And there's a lot of great subsidies if you immigrate and become a citizen. And I was still kind of rah-rah about the Zionism thing. So I immigrated. I did a master's degree at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And I was continuing in a, the rah-rah Zionism kind of deflated to a degree, because when you actually live in Israel, and this is an important dynamic in terms of where we are with the diaspora versus people living there, it becomes a lot less sexy to think about Israel as this idyllic place that doesn't exist. Because when you're there and you have to go to like the equivalent of Home Affairs or the driving license center, it's a nightmare. I mean, it's not a nightmare. The society is like a very hard society, and we here in the diaspora hear about how this is quite a cute thing, and Israelis are sabras and they're prickly, but they really mean so well. But when you're actually living there and you want to like buy groceries or get your license renewed, and people are just horrific to each other, it gets old quick, and then you become kind of hardened. So anyway, I was doing the academic thing. I took a year in Europe in Budapest to do another master's degree. And my plan was to move into a PhD program at the Hebrew University. And this was about 2008, 2009. And then things went a little differently, somewhat serendipitously. I had made some friends with a number of professors at the Hebrew University, and they had told me that they were going out to the West Bank to go along Palestinian shepherds in the South Hebron Hills. So the area around Hebron is got a lot of very notorious settlements in terms of like the aggression of the settlers there. And it's a very beautiful part of the world in many ways. And there's a lot of shepherds that can't take their flock to the land, or can't, go to their olive trees during the olive harvest, things like this. And so this group of Israeli left-wing professors and students would go out there at the invitation of these Palestinians and essentially walk with them. The idea being, if Israelis are present, then the army's not going to come and shoot at them, or the settlers aren't going to come and attack them. That wasn't the case, but that was the idea. And this group was called Tayush, which is, I believe it's an Arabic word for coexistence. Sorry, fighting the cold a little bit. And this was around the time that Twitter and social media was taking off. So I found myself in the Southwest Bank, watching these situations unfold, quite shocked at the brutality and just the naked aggression that was being carried out in front of me and regardless of me. Because I had this idea that as a Jewish man, which is how you called me, I feel a little triggered by that, to be honest, but whatever. We'll leave that to the side. I was shocked that this was transpiring before my eyes. I'd never seen anything like this happen. We would show up on a Friday afternoon or a Friday morning or a Saturday afternoon or whatever. We'd get there with these Palestinian shepherds that were basically shepherds, like living in tents. Like, we're talking about really sophisticated people. And then the army would just start shooting at us, or the settlers would come with poles and start beating people randomly. And then one of the Israelis would get arrested because the army would come and say, this is a closed military zone. That was their favorite thing to do. And they'd say, this is a closed military zone. Anyone that's here will be arrested. And then we'd sit there with a bunch of settlers. The settlers would like kind of hang out. They wouldn't be touched. And then the activists would be arrested. So this was really, really quite shocking to see it up close and personal. And as I said, this is the beginning of social media, so I started tweeting about it, as one does, and it got a lot of attention very, very quickly. And all of a sudden, people were coming to me and kind of saying, "Oh, well, you're a journalist there." And I was like, "No, I'm not. I'm just," but I had the ability to like interact in Hebrew because I had learned Hebrew by that point with what was going on, because all of this is in Hebrew. That's another aspect of this conflict that we can discuss about how people aren't really clear of what's happening because it's in a different language. So I could access that realm. And as an American, I could, access speak as an American Jew saying, yeah, this is really atrocious stuff. And so that's how I arrived at reporting on this. And then slowly this kind of became my life and work. I was commissioned to write an article, and then I got paid to do it. And I was like, well, I should do another one. And then I started writing about it quite a lot. And a group of Israelis and Palestinians started a magazine called 972. And I was invited to be one of the co-founders and one of the original editors. And 972 has now gone on to be quite a thing. One of our writers, and I say "our" because my brother is still on the board, but one of our writers just won an Academy Award for his film No Other Land, which is amazing. So that's quite cool. So I got, pushed in. It's kind of, I was in the right moment, the right place in terms of how media was shifting and in terms of the tools that were available for media. And so after I was living in Jerusalem at the time, and I had lived in Tel Aviv and Herzliya, and I had been there for a good couple of years at that point. I decided to make the move and move to Ramallah for a variety of reasons. So this was a really long way to get to that point, but living in Ramallah was probably the most powerful and happy experience that I had living in Israel-Palestine, full stop, which is a strange thing to say because it is under occupation and whatnot. So the main reasons why that is, why that is what I found when I started talking with Palestinians and engaging with Palestinian society was the conversation that I was actually quite desperate to have when I moved to Israel originally. And that's the conversation of what it means to be on the outside or what it means to be a minority. As someone that had this very conflicted identity and upbringing, that had access to privileged spaces in the United States as a white man, but always felt that I was, you know, I felt that I was Jewish. I was Jewish and I was kind of on the outside. And that ability of wrestling with what that meant to be kind of on the fringes was a conversation that I thought that I would have in Israel. But what I found was that Israelis were just mostly focused on themselves and on telling me that I wasn't part of them, which is a really funny thing to say. Like I actually felt like I encountered a form of anti-Semitism when I moved to Israel, because when I would move to Israel, it was always, oh, well, you're an American. You're not really from here. Look, you have an accent when you speak Hebrew. And then if you start saying something critical about the society, like, hey, maybe this isn't a great idea with the thing that you were doing here, then it's, well, you're not from here. Right. So it's a weird form of distancing. When I moved to Ramallah and I would sit in coffee shops and bars in Ramallah, Ramallah is a Christian town. There's great bars and restaurants. And I would talk to Palestinians of my age or, you know, similar background. The conversations were wild and all over the place. And we were wrestling with these ideas. And you'd be like, oh, have you read, you know, what Kafka was talking about with his father? And like they were reading that stuff and they were thinking about that stuff. And then I was exposed to this whole canon of Palestinian thought, like Darwish and Ghassan Hanafani and all these kind of people like that were wrestling with the exact issues that I was interested in. Obviously from a different entry point, because they're Palestinian Arabs and I'm a Jewish American, but it was there. And so I felt at ease finally after years of being in this place, which was just so random. And so, yeah, we lived there for a while. Then I ended up moving to Istanbul to continue journalism. Also then, long story short, there was like the 2011 Arab revolutions kind of happened. So I was like in Egypt a lot, in Jordan a lot. I went to Istanbul a lot. So then we kind of moved outside of Ramallah and were more regional. But that was the experience. And now I continue to engage in the heaviness and the dynamics of the material from the diaspora, from South Africa, where I live now, which is ultimately, in my opinion, and we can kind of stop this section here, where I think most people should be engaging with these topics. I think being inside of Israel is not necessarily the right place for these conversations to unfold. I don't think they're able to unfold in the same way inside of Israeli society as opposed to outside.
Can you explain that a little bit? That's really interesting.
Well, I mean, this gets down to the heart of the Zionist idea itself, and that the fact that Zionism was one attempt to reconcile the question of how did Jews live in the modern world, right? And this has been going on since modernity, right? We have a group of people, Jewish people, that Orthodox Jewish people live by a set of laws and commandments and religious statutes that are essentially anti-modern in nature. And when I say anti-modern, anti-Christian modernity, right? So they are at odds with European secular Christian West, and yet we want to engage with them. What do we do as Jews living in these societies? How do we reconcile this? And there's a lot of different ways. Like you've got the Hasidic way, which is let's just go super internal. We're going to dress up in funny costumes anytime we go out on the road so that everybody knows we're different. We're going to ghettoize ourselves and we're not going to engage in modernity. We're just not going to do it. Or you have like Reform Judaism in Germany. That was a very clear attempt to try and where, you know, I grew up in a Reform shul. And when I went to an Orthodox synagogue, I was like, what the fuck's going on here? Right? Reform shuls are like going to church. You go and there's pews, and then the rabbi comes and gives a sermon and he's wearing a nice suit, where you go to an Orthodox shul and it's like people walking around. There's like a goat in the back. It's like, what's going on? Like, it's like way all over the place. So, I mean, maybe not a goat, but.
That's Joseph's humor, everyone. That's Joseph's humor. We
yeah,
got it.
Sorry.
With a big pinch of salt, he likes to just throw out a little.
Yeah. Yeah, so not a goat, but they are unruly, especially if you go to an Orthodox shul in Israel. Like this, there's no clear start and stop, that people are doing their own thing, whatever. So this is a problem. Like Reform Judaism in Germany didn't work, right? I mean, look at what happened in the Holocaust. The Jewish community in Germany was so interested in becoming part of German society that they essentially went, we will make our Judaism into Christianity as much as we can. You can eat sausage and you can not do anything on Shabbos, whatever you want. Like, we are going to Christianize Judaism. Inside of this realm, and there's other attempts, you know, in France, they had a different attempt because the French Revolution happened and the Jews were just kind of given emancipation and inclusion into French society very quickly. But then there was the residue of anti-Semitism, like with the Dreyfus Affair and things like that. So there's lots of different attempts. And then along comes Zionism, and Zionism is one of those attempts. And at the time when it came through, back in the late 19th century, you know, 1800s, it was essentially discredited. And we talk now, I mean, I was talking to a friend that was saying, you know, Zionists used to be considered kind of the crazy cousins. Like, yeah, sure, you're going to go move to Palestine and live in the dirt and stuff. Great, that makes a lot of sense. You go do that and, you know, start a cult over there or whatever it is. Like, so it's been one attempt, and through a series of historical factors and whatnot, when it comes to the Holocaust and other issues, it's become the dominant one. And all of a sudden we have a state, right? And yet we have the ideology of Zionism is something that is really moving towards the creation of a state. We now have a state, but we still have the same ideology. And so that makes it very difficult and a kind of moving target. How did we get on this topic again? What were we talking about?
You were saying that being in the diaspora is a
right.
better place to discuss Zionism.
Right. Okay.
And I was curious about your idea of Zionism as a way of managing being Jewish in a modern context. I mean, I think you the way you depicted it is maybe slightly underplaying the role of the Holocaust. And I think, you know, I'm really curious about this in particular, because yes, there was Zionism before the Holocaust, and I think that a lot of people don't even know that. But the way that the West kind of offered the piece of land that is now Israel to Jewish people to do Zionism in a different way, in a real way, in a material way, had so much to do with the Holocaust and the atrocities there, and what was, I guess, if you kind of generous, was the sort of wish to offer safety and protection to a people that had historically been almost eradicated in Europe, etc. So, I mean, just speak to me a little bit about that and what you understand about that, and how, if we speak from a place of like how Jewish Zionist people who may even live outside of Israel believe in Israel and what it represents to Jewish people, and I think this phrase of like to offer Jewish safety, like what is your understanding of how that is felt, how that is experienced for a Jewish person, or how it is taught, or how it is imposed on people's, like as a doctrine of like what you know, why we should adopt Zionism, for example.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. So we can't in any way, in any form, underplay the need for safety and the desire for safety for Jewish communities or for Jews writ large in the wake of the Holocaust. That has to be the departure point. And it in no way should be dependent on the need for safety for other peoples. Like, it is what it is. It exists by itself. Jews need safety in the world. We have to leave from that departure point. It's understandable that a marginalized movement inside of the Jewish community, which is what Zionism was, right? Zionism going into the Holocaust was a marginalized Jewish nationalist movement. And the evidence of that is the fact that Jews didn't move there. Right? It was not successful. The only way that Israel became successful is because of the genocide of Jews in Europe. So we can't confuse, oh, we're living in a post-genocide period, and therefore, you know, Israel's our great savior. Like, Israel's fallen into place, and it wasn't a popular option. It was probably a very bad option. It is still not a great option. And again, even though we still have this dynamic of we need this place, there are a lot of Jews that live outside of Israel. In fact, the biggest Zionists I know personally don't live in Israel. And I have a joke. I'm like, you know, because when they really frustrate me, I'm like, geez, my great wish for you would be actually to move there and have to deal with it, right? Like because, and so you have this, we're getting into a realm of, I don't want to say cognitive dissonance, but we're getting into this realm of really deep confusion whereby, and I grew up with this dynamic. It was ingrained in me that Israel has to be this strong place because maybe I'll have to go there one day. That was the narrative I grew up with as a child, right? That's our safety policy because we are so happy in the United States. Why would we ever leave the United States? Because that's really the ultimate place that I can be a Jew. In many ways, it is. Why would I ever go to Israel? That's crazy. I don't even speak the language. But this is my insurance policy because of what happened in Europe. Okay, that's fair. I don't think that's not fair. That makes rational sense. However, when you start scratching the surface a little bit, then you got to say, well, it assumes that Israel operates in this realm of only thinking about Jewish safety, right? And that Israel doesn't do that. Israel operates in a realm as a nation state. Israel is its own nation state, and nation states have their own goals and priorities. One of the clear ways that we see this dynamic unfold is that Netanyahu last week went to Washington. On his way to Washington, he stopped in one European country, which was Budapest, and he met with Viktor Orban, who is a militant anti-Semite. I have never experienced anti-Semitism like I did when I lived in Budapest when it was governed under Viktor Orban. So if I am sitting here and I'm thinking to myself, I'm concerned legitimately about my Jewish safety and Israel's my insurance policy, and then I look up at the news and I'm like, why is the prime minister of Israel stopping in one European capital and it's with a notorious anti-Semite? Or talk about Trump. I mean, we could go up and down about whether or not Trump is an anti-Semite, but he feels very anti-Semitic to me, okay? When he goes out and he says, like, about when he calls Nazis, actual Nazis in Charlottesville, very fine people, it's hard for me not to see that as a pro-anti-Semitic kind of leaning. I'm sorry. And yet I'm told by the great supporters of Israel because of anti-Semitism, right, that Trump is a great ally of this country. This is a very hard thing to make sense of. And so on the surface of it, from a rational point of view, I don't think you can really make sense of it. You have to look into this extremely convoluted way that Jewish identity has developed in the post Holocaust age, which we are very much in. In many ways, the Holocaust has not ended. This idea, you know, it's actually ironic that we're talking about it now because it's Holocaust Remembrance Day in Israel, like tonight. And then it goes, the way that they've set it up is so unusual from a psychological perspective in which they have Holocaust Remembrance Day. It's super sad and somber the way it should be. And then it goes right into Independence Day, which is a huge party. So it, again, it's this narrative of the Holocaust happened, it's in the past, but we have this state now, right? And we're in a post-Holocaust phase. But I reject that because we have a state that is not secure. We have a state that has no borders. Tell me where Israel's borders are. They don't exist because they won't. There's no peace agreement in place. Like, where does it start and where does it end? Is it at the West Bank, the border? You know, so we have a state that is fundamentally insecure. We have a state that's fundamentally irrational. And even hardcore Zionists will be like, yeah, maybe we got to stop killing so many children. Like, we have a state that acts with extreme violence. Okay, so I don't see that as a post-Holocaust time for Jews. I see this as a continuation of that Holocaust period.
Okay. So this is, I think, is a really important point, something that is so subtle, but I really have been thinking about this a lot as well, which is when you say you don't think the Holocaust is over, can you kind of identify, because I think for people, I don't think a lot of people understand this, but how do we as a community, quote unquote, I mean, as you just said, our identities are convoluted and complex and multitudes of Jewish identity. So it's not like one monolithic thing. But if you think about your childhood, your upbringing, and the sort of mainstream Jewish sort of ideological framework, How, and you mentioned Remembrance Day, Holocaust Remembrance Day. How does the Holocaust get kept alive in and continuous? Like, tell me about that and like how you think that impacts everybody.
Well, I mean, it's the larger thing. The Holocaust is an extreme example of anti-Semitism. And, Jean-Paul Sartre wrote a book called The Anti-Semite and Jew, in which he argued that anti-Semitism is essentially the glue that keeps the Jews together. That if there is an external force and danger, that is what keeps us together. And if we step back, it is a way of looking at, I don't want to say the health of the Jewish community, but as we're still negotiating where we sit as Jews in the Western world, right? We're dealing with waves of intermarriage and attacks on the Jewish religious aspects of the faith, right? I am the product of intermarriage. I happen to be born of a Jewish mother, so I'm considered Jewish, but it could have easily been a Jewish father, and then I wouldn't be considered Jewish. So if we look at Cape Town, for example, and we've built the Jewish community around certain poles of identity and space, like Herzliya as the schooling system. And Herzliya, you can see now there's a lot more, and this isn't my commentary on it. I'm just like pointing this out. I don't have a horse in this race. I'm saying that we can see a lot more considered non-Jewish students in Herzliya, right? So students that are born of a Jewish father, but not a Jewish mother. So when it comes time for bar mitzvahs and stuff like that, they will not be permitted entrance to the mainstream Jewish religious institutions. That's a problem. What do you do with a kid that's not fully accepted, even if it's like low key? Well, we do have this other thing, which is Zionism, because everybody can be a Zionist, right? Anyone can be, if you have any sort of attachment to Judaism, you can just move deeply into the, well, we've got the state and all this. And Israel plays on that as well in terms of its own immigration policies, right? So was that answering your question? I'm a little spotty here, sorry.
So I think what I'm trying to say is that I've been thinking about how, and I think Melanie, no, her name is not Melanie, Naomi, Naomi Klein. There's a Melanie Klein in psychology, but no, Naomi Klein has written about this. I think she wrote an article about this, about how what that that how like looking at the sort of the reason behind the identification with Israel and the fact that for a lot of Jewish people the it's a coarse way of saying it, but the narrative is we're gonna commit a genocide because if we don't commit a genocide, they're gonna genocide us. And that they live permanently in a state of we are in imminent genocide. We are, and I think that goes to the point of what you said, that we are still in the Holocaust, which, and I think that one of the ways that we do that psychologically is as a culture, and I think what's really interesting about being Jewish is that there's the Jewish religion, there's the Jewish ethnicity, which is what you're speaking about, which is like the bloodline, and then there's the Jewish culture, which is, what are the rituals, what are the tropes of this personhood that we kind of continue. And like one of the things is this thing that I think is partly a Zionist endeavor, it's like part of the Zionist machine, which is that we drum home to children about the Holocaust in a particular way, which is not we need to get over the Holocaust, we need to recover from the trauma, we need to move past this, we are safe now, we are okay, look at what we have, look at our fortune, look at our power, look at our privilege. No, we just drum home and repeat and like dig at the wound of the trauma, which is you get told about the Holocaust in school in a very particular way. You get told particularly about the quantity, the number of deaths, you go on these trips, these school trips to, I mean, I haven't personally had this happening, but I'm referring to like the general kind of way it's taught is like you go on school trips and it's about, these piles of shoes and piles of items that were like from deceased people from the Holocaust. And all of this, including the Remembrance Days and everything else, feels to me like it is about paralysis in time. It's about maintaining this continuity where we, as you said, we don't ever leave that place of being the threatened minority without any privilege, without any power. And I think that that's such an important and tragic state. And that that is what informs, I think, a lot of the emotional reasoning that people have for why they support Israel, for why they support what's being done, and why they excuse and why they manage that cognitive dissonance that you report, you know, that like they can bypass that because of the emotional material that they have in their bodies around this trauma and this reality that they feel is real, that they are in the Holocaust, that they're just seconds away from being eradicated, if that makes sense. So yeah, what do you think of that?
I think there's it's a very good analysis of what's going on. I think that there's two things happening. Number one, the Israelis have really, they understand that that's a huge card of support. Because again, when we think about the Israelis, they are a state, right? We have to divorce this idea that they are just these noble Jews fighting the wars of David or whatever they think, you know, whatever the narrative is. They are a state with their own interests. They understand that they have PR interests and that they need a certain amount of support, especially from wealthy, you know, diaspora communities that have political power. And so one way that they achieve this is that they have equated anything anti-Israeli or anti-Zionist with something anti-Semitic, which is not true, right? I can say this Israeli policy, like if I go and I say, I tried to pick up a driver's license at the place in Hadera and they're terrible, horrific people that don't know what they're doing. I'm not saying that because of anti-Semitism. I'm saying it because the state doesn't work. And the same goes for their behaviors. But the Israelis push that. I was just at a Bri recently, and someone said to me that they're going back to services because everybody hates us or something. It was some weird construction. I was like, really? What? Okay. And then I realized, oh, that's the Israeli programming, that anything about us is about you and vice versa, right? Which is not true. And that needs to break down. And that's an aspect of like their own political aims. In terms of the Holocaust being this visceral aspect of identity that you're talking about, I think that's absolutely right. That's what I was raised in. I think it's changing, to be honest with you. And I think that's one of the reasons why there is this feeling of, there's a hysterical feeling, I think, underneath the current of Jewish communities. One could say that it was triggered by October 7th, which is true. It was in many ways, but it's a much deeper feeling. And that is, how does this identity change? My wife's grandmother was born in Lithuania and quite literally fled the Holocaust and died last year at 96. That's a big deal. That means that my kids aren't really going to have those visceral experiences around the dinner table. And a lot of other families will have that as well. And so you will have a certain erosion where time moves us forward away from that. And the question will be, how will we maintain it? How are we going to maintain? Because the normative Jewish community wants to maintain that. Because the more you're scared and the more that you equate anything anti-Israel with anything anti-Semitism and it triggers that Holocaust reaction, the more you're going to blindly support whatever the Israelis do, right? And that's the end game, because you have to blindly support what they do. You need to put it on your Instagram. You need to do this and not question. And you need to keep that level of superiority. That never again means never again for anybody, but not really. It's really just never again for us. So fuck everybody else, right? Like you have to maintain that from their point of view. And what I'm trying to say is that that's totally changing, right? And I think you see it most clearly in the United States. There's a big pushback, you know, and that's also because of the construction of American Jewish identity, right? I mean, the story that I like to say is that in Washington, D.C., there's the National Mall of Museums, which is kind of a representation of the cultural life of the United States. You've got the Smithsonian, you've got all of these beautiful museums. And then, you know, if you get a museum there, it's really like you are on the face of the American cultural plane. So the Jews were given a museum, right, on the National Mall. There was an African-American museum that came out, which was really interesting. The Jews were given a museum many years ago, and they decided that, well, I mean, let's think about it. If you're given a museum to American Jewish culture and life to be on the National Mall of the United States, what would be in there, right? One would think it would be like pastrami sandwiches, Seinfeld, I guess Woody Allen's canceled, but maybe Woody Allen at a time. Like these things, these how Jews have contributed to the cultural life of the country. John Stewart, what they did is they made a Holocaust museum, right? So you have the National Holocaust Museum. So they created a museum that is a memorial to the massacre of European Jews. They're not even American Jews. This is a really weird identity issue, right? So that for an American Jew like me growing up, my identity poles, my foundation was the Holocaust, which again is Europeans that were killed in Europe, and Israel, which is Israelis that speak Hebrew. What about me playing baseball and watching Seinfeld? That has nothing to do. Like, where's my identity here? And I think with Israel's actions and how aggressive and really over the top they've become, because it was starting a while ago with this boom in social media, you know, a lot of my tweets were getting picked up and I was asked to speak to a lot of Jewish groups in the United States, like Students for Justice in Palestine, these Jewish groups, If Not Now, Not in My Name, all these Jewish groups that came up that are getting stronger and stronger and stronger that were like, look, we just, it's almost that they didn't want to even be anti-Zionist. They were just like, we just don't want to deal with this. Like, this isn't us. Our life is in the United States. This is what we want to focus on. And that trend's going to keep going as the Israelis become more and more aggressive. So the tension will be, how does the old guard let go of that, right? How does the old guard let go of that kind of Holocaust energy or ethos and allow for the new guard to come through? Now, I mean, my final thing I'll say about that is that I don't think the conversation will happen neatly. You know, it's kind of like when you argue about Israel-Palestine with your family members, it's generally because you have an issue with your family in some way, and then you use this as a vehicle to, I mean, maybe I'm talking about from my experience, but I think it does happen with other people where it becomes this other dynamic and it becomes this esoteric thing for people in the diaspora, right?
I'm not sure about that last point, but but I think what you're saying, and I just want to pick up on this idea of new God and old God. Like, for me, what I find really interesting here, and I just want to bring like a more vulnerable position here, which is that I really empathize with the stricken, traumatized version that is what we might be calling the old guard. That there is that if you are taught from the day you are born in a system that is closed, I mean, that's the most important thing as well, is that we often in these sort of like close-knit communities where you are encouraged to stay within the bounds of the community. Like you mentioned, you know, even just the idea of like intermarriage is like, it's like, you know, diluting this thing. And I think, so we're talking about a network, a community that is close-knit. So you're getting this, the messages of that being, you know, that's, it's something that you don't get a lot of reprieve from. So you're swimming in it. You're swimming in it, and it's teaching you that you are the most important thing about your identity is that you were once, you know, that there was a genocide against you, that it may have me was even your grandparents that were killed or survived the genocide, and that is an absolute, you know, fundamental quality to who you are in the world today. And that anyone who criticizes any system that says it is acting with your interests at heart is therefore threatening your interests, threatening your existence, right? It's an existential threat to you. You can understand then why people are sort of, as you called it, a hysteria, that there's a emotional frequency, there's a resonance that people are living with, that who, if you say to them, how can you support Israel, they just think, you're telling me to like, I don't know, crucify myself, like to put myself out into the world as a vulnerable, you know, person and say, here, you know, shoot me now, kind of thing. You know, it's just that jump, I think, is so important for people to understand that, like, we're talking about, and I think the way I like to think about it as well is this idea of trauma. And like, when we learned about trauma in masters, There was a seminal work by Judith Herman. It's called Trauma and Recovery. And she talks about how you have to move through the different phases of recovery in order to actually get past the trauma. Otherwise, you stay traumatized. And it's actually really easy to stay traumatized. The trauma is designed in a way. I mean, the way trauma works is it stays in you and you get kept frozen in time. And your brain responds to various stimuli in your environment as if you are back in the trauma. And that is actually how trauma works. And we have to make an effort. We have to do work to move through that so that we can actually heal from trauma, to recover from trauma. And one of the most important ways we do that is by shifting the narrative from victim to survivor, and from being in a bodily experience of helplessness and powerlessness into a bodily experience of agency and power and autonomy. And I think that, like, collectively, the Jewish community, and yes, you know, the multitudes of Jewish community, but ultimately this kind of collective old guard, as you called it, is in a traumatized state, not really wanting to face that maybe there is, because, you know, yes, on some level you would think, well, why are you holding on to this helplessness? Why are you holding on to this victimhood? Why do you need to feel like you are minutes away from being genocided? That sounds awful. You know, let go. It's cool. You can move on. But I think it's really interesting to me that that's not how we're not encouraged to move on. We're not encouraged to heal. We're not encouraged to, but then this new guard, as you say, I think are probably the people that maybe not, I won't say individually are more healed, because I don't think that's fair, but, and it's probably, like you said, other traumas, family traumas, that people come in with their anti-Zionism and bring the anti-Zionism in a traumatic way. That's also very possible and true, because we're complex human beings. But I think that, like, if I look back and I say, okay, what is, if the new God is saying something about who Jews are in the world, I think what the new God is saying is, we're good. We're good now. Like, look where we are. We're good. We're safe. We're okay. Like, look at how successful we are as a diaspora. Look at how successful Israel is. Like, we're doing good. We're good here. Like, we're, you know what I mean? And I think that's really interesting, because I feel that as, like, I would say new God Jews. Like, I feel like I'm sort of saying, I've so been completely included into whiteness. And so I've got power and privilege that my ancestors never had. And I am very aware of that. And I mean, like, thinking about being in South Africa, which is such an interesting kind of next stage of, like, identity stuff. But, like, here we are. We might have been refugees from the Holocaust, but two generations later, we are the privileged minority who are the sort of quote unquote ruling class, even though that's obviously a complex statement. But yeah, I don't know. What do you think of that?
I really like the energy of that statement, although I will say that I guess I have a bit of an unorthodox view, in that I feel like we're actually at our most vulnerable period. Okay. because of the wedge that the Israeli mindset has driven inside of us. I do agree with you that we have a certain amount of privilege and stability in many places. But when I think back to the States, I see real anti-Semitism coming up. And my concern is that we're in a situation where an anti-Semite can go and shoot up a synagogue, but if they're pro-Israel, it's like, well, yeah, you know, he loves Trump and they're pro-Israel. Like, so we're really quite deluded in many ways. I guess what was coming up for me is that it is okay to be sad about things. I feel like that is the emotion that is there that almost wants to be stamped out when it comes to, like, the more hyper-Zionist debates. Like, this idea that Zionism is somehow the end of Jewish history, right? You know, Francis Fukuyama wrote that famous book in the 90s, The End of History, that everybody makes fun of because the United States won over the Soviet Union. So he said liberal democracy is won over the world. And now that's obviously not the case. And so it was a joke. But the Israelis have adopted a similar position, in that this is the ultimate realization of Jewish history. We longed for 2,000 years to have a state, and now we have a state, and we have nukes, and we have all this stuff, and we're just dealing with these problems. But this is the end of history, right? We're fine now. And I think this is another part in a very long and expansive and beautiful historical record of Jewish people. And my hope is that we can take more solace in looking at that record and what did it mean to be a Jewish person in 15th century Spain, when there was massive waves of forced conversion. Like, we've gone through a lot and we're still going through it. So the idea that the Israelis, even though they're dealing with these conflicts, are somehow going to end that and deliver Jews to a new realm, which is that's their stated aim. I mean, that was the goal that Herzl had, was that once we had a European state, everything would be fine, and it's not fine. So yeah, the energy of recognizing the trauma and sitting with it and seeing what the trauma response brings up, I think is incredibly valuable. But at the same time, I don't think that necessarily saying we've reached the end of history in the diaspora as well is viable. I think we're still very much in the muck, and we need to free ourselves. We need to step back from a lot of the ideological framework that's been imposed on us in our current right now, not necessarily South Africa, because that has its own thing. But if we can do that, and we can look at ourselves as part of a chain of people that have been living and dealing with these issues for thousands of years, then maybe we can find some more solace and more examples of people that struggled with these issues over thousands of years, right? Like, we don't need to silo ourselves into the Holocaust in Israel. So I kind of feel like it's kind of similar to what you're saying, just a little different.
No, I love what you said, and I think it's really beautiful and I think meaningful. And I think what's important to say is, like, if I'm dealing with someone in therapy who's experienced a trauma, I can't tell them that they're going to be safe.
Right.
Ever. Right. Like, that's not something we can guarantee. Life is not you can't offer guaranteed safety going into the future. The future is unknown. But that doesn't mean that you have to be traumatized. That doesn't mean you have to live with the assumption that you are in danger, because that, what happens with that, honestly, is that we're not experiencing life. We're not really benefiting from what we do have access to. And so I think there's something really beautiful about what you said about sadness and about the idea of, like, I think that what is sad about any right-wing politics, really, but any kind of right-wing ideology, is that it's actually just so narrow. It offers its proponents such a narrow band of existence. And actually, I think if we can expand that and be open to the fact that, like, we are in some part in danger, and there is anti-Semitism, and that is real, and we are also in some ways safer than we've ever been, and that is real. And there is ways in which the project of Israel has been exceptionally successful and offered Jews something that they wouldn't have had if it wasn't for that. And in some ways, it has been incredibly unsuccessful and has cost lives of Palestinian people and Jewish people unnecessarily, but obviously mostly Palestinian people. And that, as a person, as a human being, even if I'm traumatized, I don't feel it's okay to harm another person so that I don't get harmed in the future. I know that that's true for me as an individual. And I just wish that we could, I think that the Jewish people that I follow at the moment that I really admire are people who stand up for that, who's saying, that's not Jewish, right? That's not Jewish to feel that it's okay that other people get harmed so that I am safe. That's not okay. And so, yeah, I just think that it's a sort of everything thing that I'm imagining. What you're saying is, like, to reckon with history, to bring history with us, but then also to know that if we only talk about one strand of history, we are just, you know, narrowing this field of experience, and we're missing out on something, and others are obviously suffering.
It's very important to amplify those voices you're talking about, especially the ones that are on the ground as well. You know, my experience that was so pivotal in the West Bank was being around born and bred Israelis in the West Bank. And so in terms of the other and in terms of confronting the fear, you know, if I speak to people that I know in Cape Town and say, hey, let's go get a sandwich with a Palestinian, even that would be like, oh, are you kidding me? And it's like, I lived in Ramallah as a proud, we had a Passover Seder in our flat in Ramallah, no problems. Now, granted, people might say, well, you're deluded or you're, you know, you hid your Jewishness. Absolutely not. That's not what was going on. I didn't go in there wearing a military uniform, driving a tank with an Israeli flag. That would be a different story. But in terms of being a Jewish person, just that, forget about an American Jewish person, a South African Jewish person, an Israeli Jewish person, whatever. Being a Jewish person in this world, we can and we have the power, and it's happening all the time, to cross over the void and engage with especially Palestinians and Arabs. Dealing with white nationalist anti-Semites in the United States might be a little different story. And the fact that that's a harder story and those people also tend to be kind of big Israel supporters, that's another dynamic. But in terms of amplifying the voices that are saying, this isn't Jewish, right? This doesn't feel right. Or the people just last week, I've got a friend named Jonathan Pollock who's been he's an Israeli. He's been very active in the Palestinian struggle for 20 years now. He was just arrested again. We need to look at that and we need to think about why is this happening? If my views on the Israeli conflict and that are informed by this position of fear and trauma, how do I understand the fact that there's an Israeli, white Israeli guy being shot at by troops holding hands with a Palestinian person in front of their field? We need to think about that. We need to look at those images and say, what happened? What allowed these people to cross over? Why did the Palestinians welcome them in? Why is this thing happening? Right? And now it's not going to be on the front page of the Jewish Chronicle, but this information is widely and easily accessible because of the relative democratization of media. So we can get that information. And I do think that, you know, it's okay to be sad, but it's also okay to lean into that development, because there are a lot of people that are breaking down those rigid psychological barriers inside of their own minds and inside of their own communities to find some sort of humanity in the other side. And when it comes to the conflict itself, that's where I think we're going, right? That's where ultimately we are going, because it is a question of seeing humanity for what it is and seeing rights for what they are. And we need to break down those barriers that you've described so well.
Yeah. Oh, I think that's a beautiful way to end off. So I'm going to, leave it at that. Thank you so much for coming to speak to me. I was absolutely thrilled with this conversation, and I feel like we did well, and you're welcome back anytime. And
thank you.
Yeah, take care. I hope you feel better soon.
A pleasure. Let's do it again.
Okay. Bye, Joseph.
Bye.